Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. We are shifting into a modality today, however, in that we are going to be stepping back into history, Egyptian history. I don't know very many people that when they start thinking about the history of Egypt, the imaginings just become overwhelming. We have, through the years, found out about the various digs, there's legends, there's all kinds of things that are spoken about with Egypt, deep, dark, mysterious items, as well as those that just absolutely are mind-boggling. Well, we're going to be experiencing a bit of that Egyptian journey through history because of a woman by the name of Normandy Ellis. Now, she is a researcher. She's put out a book called Imagining the World into Existence. And I guarantee you, it is going to surprise you, some of the things that she has found. Normandy Ellis, I welcome you to the show. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Donna. It's great to be here.
Now, you are a writer. You have been writing about history for years, but Egypt has had a particular fascination for you. You do workshops. You are a director of a retreat center called the Penthouse. Normandy, did you find when you were in school that anything about Egypt just sort of gripped you? Is this something that you just have had a natural affinity for, or did certain experiences happen to you that made you say, I want to know more about this culture? What triggered you to have this as such a significant part of your life?
Great question, Donna. I really think it did begin early. And for many of us as children, you know, we have fascinations with things that probably come from a past life experience. And I was one of those. I found myself, you know, at the age of 9, crawling into the big storm sewers at the end of the street where I lived and writing with chalk on the wall, you know. And funny, you know, I always think back on that experience and think, gee, I must have been scribe at some point, you know, working on the tombs.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what really fascinated me was that I had a friend who we grew up together on the same street. We sort of drifted apart, and then I ran into him again, and we had a long conversation about his work as a Rosicrucian. And so he convinced me that I needed to purchase a copy of the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I said, yeah, sure, I'll get it. Well, he pointed me across the street, walked me over, pulled it off the shelf, said, you buy it now. So I did, and then I didn't really know why I had bought it. Later he comes, he says, I have to move. I'm giving you all of my boxes of the Rosicrucian teachings. You know, we're not really supposed to show them around, but I have to move, and my family doesn't understand. So you just take care of them for me, you know, and I'll be back in touch. Well, to make a long story short, he died, and I ended up with all of his material. And then when I was in graduate school, I was asked by the professor, you know, we'd translate it in Spanish. He said, now translate from your other language. And I thought, I don't have another language. But he said, pick one that interests you. I said, well, here's these hieroglyphs. I'm very interested in the hieroglyphs. Got a good grammar dictionary, all the various translations. And I just started translating, and I loved it. I spent 10 years translating the Egyptian Book of the Dead from front to back 3 times. And it was very much, you know, just falling right into something that became an absolute life love, you know. So my husband at the time thought, you're spending too much time doing this. You need to get rid of those books. Well, I was going to throw them away one night, I was driving with all the boxes, all my manuscripts, you know, all of Robert's books. And I'm driving up the hill, and I look in the rearview mirror, and I see Robert sitting in the back seat of my car among all the books. And his head is shaved. He's bald as an Egyptian priest, you know. And I thought, oh, this is just my imagination. So to make sure it wasn't, he reached out and touched me. It's the first time I ever really felt that kind of vibration that spirit has when it really, you know, pushes up against you. And it really got my attention. I stopped the car. I look in the rearview mirror, and he's still there. And I said, don't ever do that again. You scared the devil out of me. And then he was gone. So, you know, I got the message. I kept working on the manuscript. And then a publisher about 2 months later contacted me and said, you wouldn't happen to have a book, would you? I said, of course. So that's the long story, but that's how it happened.
Wow. I think sharing those points is so significant. And the reason I think it's significant is that it points out how every one of us has an individual motivation. Something clicks. Something is given to us as Robert in coming back to you, letting you know, do not let this material go. I gave these to you so you could have them because you have a job to do.
That's right.
And I think that's an incredible experience.
Yeah,
I want to quote
really
from. I want to quote from your book. This is a small but significant sentence in my mind. You say Egypt did not have, but rather was, a quality of intelligence, and that's thought provoking to me. You say it did not have, but rather was, a quality of intelligence. Explain that.
I'm glad you picked up on that piece. I really feel that we talk about states of mind as if they are something that we must reach out and grasp. But it has been my impression that we are those states of mind already. And when we live our lives as if the past, the future, and the present are all rolled up in one. We are living in multi-dimensions. We are able to access wisdom that comes from places that we don't recognize as being right now. But you know, when I feel that when I write, I truly am reaching out and touching the hand of one who wrote in ancient Egypt in what we know of as like 2,500 B.C. I mean, I really can feel myself connected to that person and understanding that's part of my heritage. Egypt as a state of mind, the scribes, the priests, the pharaoh, and all the shamans who were working with the ancient Egyptians, had access to a divine plan. And they lived that divine plan. And they knew that they were more or less like atoms inside the mind that was Egypt. And it's really linked to the idea of the dung beetle as the process of always becoming and always being exactly what it is and always becoming, because change and motion and transformation is really the whole thing. That's what we live inside. We live inside the body of God.
I love that analogy of the dung beetle, because if anyone studies the dung beetle, they take what's considered waste, roll it into a ball, put their eggs, their larvae, in it, and it's total nourishment for the new life that comes. And that is a phenomenal analogy. Because
I think the dung beetle is very It's very strongly linked to Egyptian magic because it, in one way, it's those negative experiences that we had in life, you know, the dung, the lower parts of our existence that we just wish we could get through. But if we completely understood, we would see that they are in part nourishing the seeds of our future selves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really learning to, it's a process of alchemy. The dung beetle is also an alchemist, and he shows us how to turn the base, vulgar part of life into something golden, into something that is brilliant and winged, like a winged dung beetle that breaks open from the dung ball and flies into the sky.
Mm-hmm. You bring out so many different aspects of the symbology of Egyptian knowledge. One of them is the sesame seed, but let me preface with this. You had a statement in your book, rational thinking has never been the key to understanding the intricate mysteries of symbols. Now, this has been stated in so many cultures. I was reviewing material this morning by another author, and the mythology of parable is so powerful, and how different people will see things different ways, but can perhaps not be aware unless they get past what they could, what they perhaps would call the analytical thinking. And right. I find this so fascinating.
Well, I think it's a bit like, I mean, I love symbols. And I'm very much attracted to dream interpretation, Jungian interpretation, mythology that works through symbols, parable, all as you said. And I think it's because the symbol is a hologram. We understand a symbol not just mentally, but we understand a symbol on a visceral level, you know, on an emotional level, we understand it. And symbol, especially if you're looking at the way symbols appear in dreams, for example, they have a kind of life of their own. Many, many people dream in Egyptian symbols who do not even know about the myths of Egypt. And it's as if the symbol is steeped in, you know, our psyche as part of a transformational code that we come to break open and understand as we grow. So I really think symbol is more like a hologram rather than a fact.
Now, let's talk for a moment about the cosmogenesis, which is a chapter you talk about the stories of how the world began. I'm sure the people that are listening today will say, oh, yes, we've heard of this, the Native Americans. That there is not a culture in the world that does not have their mythology regarding the religions of the world, or how the world began, excuse me. And you talk about Khnum, and correct me if I'm not pronouncing it correctly.
No, that's correct.
Khnum. Now, Khnum made heaven, earth, and Duat, what is under earth, as well as water and the moon. Khnum was the father of fathers and the mother of mothers. Now, this is symbology that they utilize to tell the story in so much of the artwork. It really must have been quite a process for the person that originally was able to decipher this visual script that was put out. That was quite an accomplishment. Tell us about Khnum.
Well, Khnum he's fascinating to me because he appears not only in Egyptian mythology, but the things that are said about him appear in the stories of Yahweh creating heaven and earth. They're very similar to stories of how God made humans out of clay, in the way mm-hmm. that Khnum made humans on his potter's wheel out of clay, and he made their souls or their ba. Now, when we travel in Egypt, we go to the island of Elephantine, which is far south, up near the first cataract of the Nile. And we climb through layers of time, literally. It's an archaeological dig in process. And so you can see the fourth dynasty, you know, probably 2600 something BC, down at the very floor level of the island as you're climbing up. And you climb all the way up to the top into the New Kingdom, where there's a temple by Hatshepsut at the very top with this beautiful pink granite. And you're seeing layers and layers as you climb through. You climb through the mud, you know. You climb through cities that were built on this island that were built by Hebrew people who lived next to the Egyptian people sometime during the Middle Kingdom. You're walking through a town where you can see the mayor, you can see Khnum's temple on one side, and you can see Yahweh's temple on another side, the remains of it. You see a Jewish bakery. You see all kinds of amazing things as you climb up through these layers of history. Now, it wasn't always a side-by-side culture. Of course, there came a time when there was a very dramatic split. But it fascinates me that there was a time when those two cultures lived side-by-side and in which they shared a mutual vision of how they came into being. And I think that that goes a long way toward our understanding of how to live together as different peoples, but side by side.
Puta. The priests of Puta, and I'm quoting again from your book, knew about name, vibration, and numerology. They had a strong belief that names offer protection, and there's many people today that when they choose a name for their child, they are very thoughtful about it. They will go and they'll buy a book on names to see which one that child should have. Names are a fascinating thing. And you also state intimate names were only spoken between parent and child, husband and wife, or devotee and deity. Knowing a secret name and a sacred breath of its vowels heightened the vibration. If one knew a man or even a god's secret name, one acquired a kind of power over him or her. I find this intriguing thought. Where did you find this information where they felt thoughts were things and if you spoke something out loud, it had power? Because in the metaphysical area, people will say over and over again, thoughts are things. Be careful what you ask for. You may just get it. Words have power. We hear these statements today.
Right. And much of this, I spoke of Khnum, who lived in the southern part of Egypt, and Ptah lived in the northern part of Egypt, in Saqqara, Memphis. I mean, that would be where his temples were. And he is, again, one of the oldest, probably the first pyramid, the Step Pyramid, was built in the third dynasty of Egypt. That's about as far as we begin to have recorded history. And Ptah was speaking the world into existence. There were stories on something called the, I believe it's pronounced Shabaka Stone, and it was a stela that was erected outside Ptah's temple in Memphis. Unfortunately, we don't have the entire story because someone later found it, decided it would make a great millstone, and so part of the words have been ground away after it was used as a millstone. But we were able to find passages that show how Ptah speaks the world into being. And the other thing that we do know is that like the Hebrew alphabet, vowels are sacred in the Egyptian hieroglyphs, in the Kemetic language. The vowels are considered the breathy part of a language, the soul of a language, the God spirit of a language. And so that is why it is so difficult to understand the correct pronunciation of a particular word in hieroglyphs, because they don't use the exact vowels that we would use in our language.
And in Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, they had no vowels as well. So this is very compatible. The link and the association with Egypt, and they weren't slaves. What you're describing was not a slave positioning.
No, it was not. There were a lot of people who worked for the Pharaoh on the Pharaoh's behalf because he was, you know, we admit, the top dog, you know. But he was the one who was holding the pattern. And everyone, whether they were Egyptian or Hebrew, worked on behalf of the culture itself. It was almost like a group mind type of thing, you know, the way ants will work for, you know, a particular construction of the anthill and the recreation, you know, for the community, but they don't always know the whole pattern. The pharaoh and the shaman, the high priest, held the pattern, and they actually went into Duat, or what we might think of as the dream time, or you know, the unconscious mind. They would journey there and receive parts of the plans from the ancestors, and then continue the process of building the community. All of those pyramids are built on, over, you know, several centuries, but the plan was laid down, and when you look at it, you can realize, oh, yes, that is part of the plan. You look at Karnak, the entire temple is built on a plan with specific design, and whether it started in the Middle Kingdom or whether it was added to by Ramses II, it was part of the same plan. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's fascinating when we're discovering, archaeologists are discovering, number one, the Egyptian culture is a lot older than what we even had a clue about. And
yes.
I find it so fascinating, the arrogance of a few that say we know it all, and we're far from it. And that's one of the many points that your book covers, is that there is so much to learn and so much to discover. And you look at the many years you've been involved in this, and this is such a rich and enriching experience because we are influenced by this. It's so sad when you look at the political muck that's going on right now in the Middle Eastern area, and, you know, in Egypt, and all of the upheaval and the confusion and the frustration, all of this, and you look at this phenomenal legacy that we have evolved from that affected the Masons, it affected so many things. It's absolutely amazing to me how this has been carried forward and what we're still looking at. Now, here is something from the 6th dynasty. It was a sage, Phuthahotep, said, a man's heart is his life, prosperity, and health. In other words, what we carry in the heart becomes our destiny. Whether our actions reveal lightness or hardness of heart determines the fate of our soul. The heart retains a lifetime of memories, thoughts, feelings, actions, words, and intentions. My gracious, that we talk about even today in the health area. They're recognizing how the heart is affected by not only by nutrition, but by your feelings, what, you know, what's going on in the subconscious. We might be using different words, but we're saying the very same thing.
Yes. Yeah, I think that I love to go back and read Tahotep because it seems to me that he finds the words for so many things that we think about nowadays. You know, he cautions us to say it's not just from the priest in the temple that, you know, you learn truth, but from the lips of handmaidens at the grindstone, you know, or at the well, you know, that everyone possesses a piece of truth. And that truth is, it's interesting, as a hieroglyph, truth is sometimes written with a sign that indicates multiple, with three C's. So truth can be more than one thing. And
yes.
I think that's pretty fascinating, too.
I agree with that. And it can have so many levels to it. Depends on what angle you're reviewing what is considered truth. Due to your experience, your education, whatever. I mean, we all have our colored lenses that, due to whatever we have gone through, that affects how we perceive something. It's absolutely amazing to me. Now, you bring up a story about a woman, an English woman, Dorothy Eady. She is so fascinating. This is a woman, her name, the book by Jonathan Cott, it was In Search of Om Sati. Share a little bit of her story with us.
Oh, surely. Om Sati, or Dorothy Eady, was a young girl who took a fall and died and then returned to life. And during the time that she died, she contacted a previous life so that when she came back, she slowly began to realize that she had an ancient Egyptian life. And she understood that it was with the Pharaoh Seti as one of the court maidens, you know, in his court. She was a harpist. So Om Sati, the actual woman, went back to Egypt and lived in the city of Abydos. And she married an Egyptian man, but that didn't last long because in truth she felt herself to be married to Seti. And she took it upon herself to take care of the temple that Seti had built in Abydos. And this is Seti the First. And she had such knowledge of this place that when archaeologists would come to dig at the temple, she would say, no, don't dig there, dig here, because this is where you'll find, say, the garden. And sure enough, they would dig there and find the garden. And she would say, oh, dig here, because you'll find a cache of statues. And sure enough, they would dig there and find a cache of statues. She even knew the names of ways to pronounce. We were talking about the sacred language. She knew ways to pronounce certain words in order to send serpents back into the hole so that they would not harm anyone or bite anyone. I mean, she would use the ancient language as a spell to send them back into the recesses so that they wouldn't bite the mayor of Abydos or any of the archaeologists. So it was very interesting reading about her through Jonathan Cott's book, and I highly recommend this book because Dorothy Eady really was an embodiment of someone who lived a past life and was continuing to take what she had learned from that past life and live it now in a very full way. And there are copies, I understand, of her diary, which she kept, that are now, she gave to the mayor when she died, and they are now in circulation, and some folks have copies of these. I've yet to put my hands on it, but I'm waiting for the moment.
Amazing. Now, I want to ask a question. Normandy, would you stay with me for about another 15 minutes?
Sure.
All right. We're going to be continuing this conversation with Normandy Ellis. Her book is called Imagining the World into Existence. Now, what she's put together is an ancient Egyptian manual of consciousness. There are so many parallels with what is understood today on so many levels, and the parallels are fascinating, and she has just given such a wonderful way of expressing so much of it. So she's going to stay with us a little bit longer. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the first known female physician who was in Egypt. We're going to be talking about some other things as well. So stay with me. This is Donna Siebel. We are going to be taking a break for a moment. When we come back, we're going to be continuing this fascinating insight into a time of history that even today has a strong, strong impact, not just on our beliefs, but on so many levels of our life, regardless of what culture you may come from. It's really significant. Donna Siebel, we're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hello, this is Donna. Welcome back. We're continuing our chat with Normandy Ellis. And by the way, her website is normandyellis.com. Her book, Imagining the World into Existence, you will be able to find out more information about her, her work, what she does, her travels, her speaking engagements, all of that good stuff. And Normandy is spelled N-O-R-M-A-N-D-I. E-L-L-I-S is her last name. Normandy, thank you for staying with me a little bit longer. I'd like to talk about the first known female physician. And I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but it's Lady Pisichette?
Pisichette.
Pisichette. Say it again.
I think it's Pisichette.
Pisichette. Okay. Tell us about her, because women physicians, I mean, we know about them being involved in herbs as far back as time goes in oral tradition, but the term physician, was that coined by the Egyptians? How is it she was able to, she was quite accomplished.
She was quite accomplished. I mean, and it seems like in the Old Kingdom, more so than in the New Kingdom, women were more of equal stature among men and women, but was not uncommon to have female high priestesses or high priests and female physicians. I think that she probably was known as an herbalist in a way to start, but anyone who's dedicated to Isis or who serves Isis is probably a midwife to some degree, because Isis was, of course, the goddess of midwifery. She was the mother goddess. She was the equivalent of the Virgin Mary in the Egyptian tradition. And in fact, her name sometimes is Mary, which means beloved, Mary Set, beloved Isis. So this first physician, and I believe she's as early as the 5th dynasty, which is around like 2300 BC, she probably was a midwife. She probably had access. Of course, they had certain knives and equipment if you needed flint blades to cut the cord, perhaps even to make an incision you know, if you needed to pull the child out more. Childbirth was, you know, not what we have now, of course.
Right.
And it was very difficult. And so even as a gynecologist, the Egyptians had ways of preventing women from having children during the times of drought, which was a particularly terrible time for a woman to give birth, because she simply would not, probably not be able to feed the child as much. Everybody was sort of on a restricted diet until the flood came again and the land, you know, kicked back in reverdure. So there were ways to prevent pregnancies, which were kind of like herbal tampon type things. That's probably something that this woman would have known about. The Egyptians were the first ones to have an early pregnancy test, which is kind of amazing to me. It was a urine test, just as we have today, and the difference was that certain grains, like barley and emmer, wheat, would grow faster whether one had more progesterone or testosterone in the urine. And so not only could they tell if a child was, if a woman was pregnant with child, but what the sex of the child was going to be. And that's kind of amazing to me, too.
Yes, and you said it was over 70% accurate, which
yes, it was.
Someone might say, oh, my goodness, you've got to be kidding. No, they became aware of this, used it, and they were able to make determinations. And I find that practicing contraception, using herbs to do this, even doing spontaneous abortion. They had means of inducing that when the mother and child were at risk. And again, like you said, when you think of these things, that women had such a terrible time, fevers, disease, stillbirth, they were very, very common. Well over 50% of children for I don't know how many, many years would die.
Yeah,
and
true.
Egyptian medicine, principles that we're aware of, any good physician would have been aware of this, that the mental and emotional state of a person has a lot more of an effect on the physical condition of someone than what the Western world has adopted in its thinking. And there's just so much in here that I find absolutely amazing. And you have a section about the use of magical force. That's how you describe it. And you call it Ushabtis.
Yeah.
Ushabtis. What is this?
Well, a magical force. An Ushabti is, I guess, what you would see in the old Jewish mystical Kabbalistic tradition called the Golem, which was a figure made of clay which had certain words that could be spoken over it, and a hieroglyph that was tapped on the forehead that sort of awakened this particular Ushabti. Now, I don't believe that they came to life in the physical, but an Ushabti is a mental construct. I mean, very much so. When you think about tapping, you know, the third eye, as like bringing that idea to life. If we are able to envision something, we are able, by and large, to make it happen. And we spoke about this earlier. We have to be careful what we wish for. We have to be careful what we think or see. If you have passion connected to that vision, the likelihood of it coming to pass is much greater. So an Ushabti is basically a mental, I would say it's a mental construct that is made of clay so that it has a physical manifestation that the Egyptians then could use to hold a particular idea more completely. I hope I'm making sense. Sort of like a visual aid, if you will. Okay.
Well, you have many cultures throughout the world that you have different aspects like voodoo using clay figures. You have different shamanistic practices in South America.
And there's even in, you know, Asian culture, you have all of these different things. So those are carry-ons from this particular thing. One of the facts that you bring out in the book, which is just incredible, and this really happened, and you talk about an arabesque legend of Queen Duluka, or Daluka.
Uh-huh.
And she was just absolutely an amazing woman because the story of the pharaoh and the old story of crossing the Red Sea and how the pharaoh was overwhelmed when the Jews went through, it's a parallel to the story of the sands that swallowed the Persian army of Cambyses, and they also only recently found this in the Sahara Desert. It's outside
it's amazing
of Siwa, Oasis.
That they actually, you know, a legend has come to have
and they found it.
A truth, yes.
They found 50,000 skeletons. This entire army was swallowed and drowned in the sand so many years ago. Wow, what a discovery. That is just absolutely, absolutely phenomenal. You go into things like protection of the pharaoh. You go into so many different aspects of Egyptian history, all of which is documented. And you yourself have been to Egypt so many times. You've had some very, very strong experiences when you have been in these environments. They have really impressed you. It's almost as if you are a conduit to pass on this knowledge in the modern-day world. And you had an insight into understanding symbolism. And one of the comments you made is you said, apparently, desert wandering, as so often is mentioned about Moses and his people, it's an endemic ancient Middle Eastern curse. It's a fascinating perspective. Now, the influence on Greek life on Pythagoras, the temples of wisdom, you talk about that. And one of the things that I thought was significant is the loss of the nose on the Sphinx. Oh, it's not because of Napoleon's army. There has been a tremendous legend that's permeated history for years. Any of the history books will say, well, it's Napoleon's armies. They used it for target practice. But it wasn't then. What happened to the nose on the Sphinx?
Well, the nose on the Sphinx, you see a lot of statues that have the noses taken off. And that's mostly, you know, very hard diorite. You know, you have to really work to chisel off a nose like that. But so many of the statues have that. And a lot of times that's because another person comes into power and wants to take the power that was previous, you know, given to this other predecessor, take the Sphinx's nose, for example, to give the breath of life. You know, there's you see so many beautiful depictions of giving the breath of life to, you know, holding the ankh to the nose of a pharaoh or the deceased or a god standing before one, you know, holding up the ankh. You also see offerings of sacred oil that the pharaoh makes to the divine statue, holding his little finger up, you know, with the oil to the nose to offer life and beauty. So breathing was a very, very powerful aspect of Egyptian tradition. Now, Hu was a god of breath. There were three sacred divine beings who rode in the boat of Ra. And one was Heka, whose name means magic. One was Sia, whose name means wisdom or higher knowledge. And the other was Hu, who sometimes is translated as utterance, but really it's who is the breath, you know, coming forth from the nose, from the mouth. So the nose, again, has to do with that, the power of magic as manifested by who, the God who.
Well, I'll tell you, I know we're out of time here. This book is fascinating. If you really have a love of ancient Egypt, this will give you a perspective that you have never before experienced. You'll see the parallels between what was taught centuries ago and how it has been carried forth by different cultures. There's even information about the Papyrus of Ani in the British Museum now that was put there in 1888. It is the largest continuous papyrus ever found. And it's just, there's amazing information in here. So if you're intrigued, and if you really want to have an enjoyable read that'll give you pictures of history and understanding, it will enlarge your perspective of how things can be passed down through the traditions of writing, oral communication, various aspects of ritual, how we carry them forth. Normandy Ellis has been my guest today. Normandy, it's been a joy. Check out her website, normandyellis.com. And Normandy is spelled N-O-R-M-A-N-D-I, Ellis, E-L-L-I-S. It has been a delight. I wish you continued success. Check out her site so that you can find out where she's going to be, normandyellis.com. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedros accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now. Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are open, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, in the time remaining, I wanted to share with you some information, actually a recipe. If you really want something that is healthy, fragrantly wonderful when it's baking, great for breakfast, or if you wanted to have it for a dessert, you could do that. Well, I'm going to give you a recipe for oatmeal. And this is what you'd call healthy, healthy stuff, but it has some good flavor to it. So I wanted to share it with you. But before I do that, I wanted to mention, for those of you in Western Washington, Quantum Mind 4 is coming up on November the 3rd, which is a Saturday. It's going to be from 10 to 4. It's a full-day seminar. And Robert Newman, this is going to be our last class that we're going to be presenting in the year. He is going to be talking about Asian secrets for longevity. And there's just so much good information he's going to be sharing. He's going to be doing the first part of the program. I'll be doing the second half. We'll be talking about development of your own intuitive skills. Believe it or not, you can develop them. And you are going to have the chance to do exercises, and those that, all of those that are attending are going to be interactive. This is the type of class I love to teach because it is so wonderfully intimate, and it's just a great environment to be able to
ask questions and just be a participant. So this is November the 3rd, and information is coming out in my newsletter. That's going to be coming out on the 1st. And all you need to do, if you'd like to register for this class, is give me a call at 253-582-5604, and I'm going to be giving you more information coming up. The world's oldest published recipe. Now, what do you think the food would be? Beer, wine, bread, or cheese? What do you think the oldest known recipe that we're aware of at this time that was published? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, take your guess. It's beer. Beer is a fermented liquid, and fermentation was a process of utilizing whatever people had so they could preserve it for winter. And beer was a brew that just about, on one level or another, every culture produced. So the oldest recipe is for beer. Now, this is a recipe that was put together by Heidi Swanson, and it involves oats, fruit, milk, and an egg. And she calls it a cross between bread pudding, pie, and oatmeal. Now, she makes it the night before she's going to bake it. So if she's going to be with some friends, having a brunch, whatever it is that's going on, she said, I really love doing this. And she enjoys entertaining in her home, and she says, this is just absolutely wonderful because I can prepare it the night before, and all I have to do is pop it into a hot oven of 375 degrees, and you put it up in the top third of your oven. She said, you have the rack in the top third when you're baking it. Now, here are the ingredients, and kids are going to love this. It is 2 cups of rolled oats. Now, you don't want to use instant. You want to use the old-fashioned steel-cut oats. You're going to need 1/2 cup of walnuts, and she likes to toast them before she puts them into this. And then you chop them up. You're going to need 1/3 cup of sugar or maple syrup. And she said if you're going to use the maple syrup, you want to have extra. You want extra so people can pour it over this wonderful concoction she made. 1 teaspoon of baking powder, 1.5 teaspoons of ground cinnamon. You need 1/2 teaspoon of sea salt. That's what she recommends. If you don't have sea salt, use regular salt. You're going to need 2 cups of milk, 1 large egg, and then 3 tablespoons of unsalted butter melted, 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 2 ripe bananas. You want to slice those. And then you need 1.5 cups of berries. She recommends blueberries, huckleberries, or a berry of your choice, whatever it might be. Now, you're going to need an 8 by 8 inch baking pan, and you want to butter that. And you then, in a bowl, you put your oats, 1/2 of your walnuts, your sugar, and your baking powder, cinnamon, and salt. These are the dry ingredients. You just mix them. Just you can do that with your hands or a whisk. And then in another bowl, you are going to whip together your maple syrup, your milk, egg, 1/2 of your butter, and your vanilla. Then you put your bananas in a single layer at the bottom of the prepared well-buttered baking dish. You want to sprinkle 2/3 of your berries over the top, and then you cover the fruit with the oat mixture. Now, very slowly, your milk mixture, you very gently pour. And if you try to do it too fast, the oats are going to go all over the place. So you don't want to disturb them too much. And you want to give the baking dish a few thwacks, as she puts it, on your countertop to make sure the milk moves through the oats. And then you want to put your berries, your remaining berries, and toasted walnuts on the top. Now, you're going to bake this for about 35 to 45 minutes. Your oats will have set, and you take it out of the oven, and then the remaining butter you put over the top of this hot oatmeal dish. And when you serve it, have extra maple syrup, or if people prefer sugar, you can have brown sugar, white sugar, whatever you like. You sprinkle that. Have those little things set to the side. And this is wonderful. Kids would really, really enjoy it. And she said it's just been a real hit for anybody that has come over. She apparently has enjoys having the ladies over to get together for their brunch special. And she says this is something that when she's having it at her house, this is one of the items that she consistently serves because they love it. Well, my goodness, we're out of time. This is Donna Sebo. Next week, I am taking a vacation. Yes, so you're going to be getting the best of Donna, some awesome shows that we've had. Join us next week, even though I will not be live with you. I'll be back the following week. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, have a magnificent weekend, a magnificent day. Remembering always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Talk with you in about a week. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
PBS Radio.